Interview with John Bell Williams, Jackson, Mississippi, March 29th, 1974.
Looking back over this last 25 years since 1948, Governor, what have been the most significant changes in Mississippi politics?
Of course, I would say the advent of Negro voting in great numbers probably has brought about the most significant change. However, there's been very little change in the basic philosophy of a great majority of our people. Second, I would say that one of the most significant changes is the apparent trend away from the one-party system toward either a two-party system or toward a majority and minority party system that would, the majority party embracing the remnants of what we might call the old regular Democratic Party, and the minority group being the liberal or ultra-liberal elements that exist in the state. The Republican Party has sought to make inroads in Mississippi, and of course they have in a few places with the election of a couple of congressmen and one or two municipal offices and some other local offices. But oddly enough, the issues involved in those campaigns were more personal, were more in the area of personalities and platforms than in party affiliations. I think Mississippi is moving toward more toward an independent system than anything else at this point, because our people are loath to affiliate with the Republican Party, and they're sick of the present apparatus of the National Democratic Party.
When you say they're loath to associate with
yes.
To the Republican Party, is that because of the Watergate situation?
No, it has nothing to do with it. As I find it in Mississippi, the people are thoroughly disgusted with the Watergate affair, in the sense that they feel that it is is nothing more nor less than a press vendetta against the president. And I've found that our people, by and large, support the president at this point on the basis of what we know about Watergate. Most of them seem to feel that the president has made a very good president, that he has at least turned the country back somewhat to stability that we lost during the liberal era of Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson. As far as other significant changes that have taken place, of course, we've witnessed a tremendous economic revolution in Mississippi, a tremendous growth of our economy, and we witnessed a change from a cotton economy into a pretty well diversified system. I think we witnessed the disappearance of what might be categorized as the old Southern demagogue type of politician, and one who appeals more to reason than to emotion. Now, I think I suppose that comes about as a result of enlightenment, better education, and better communication systems. Beyond that, I just off the top of my head, I can't think of any other particular points that might need to be brought out.
You were governor during the massive integration, 1970. Did you anticipate it was going to go off that smoothly without incident as it did?
I hope that I made some contribution to its going off that smoothly.
But did you expect, say, back in 68 and 69, it was going to come off like that?
Quite frankly, no.
Well, why did it?
I think that, Well, I don't want to blow my horn, but I think that the primary reason for it was to be found in the attitude of the leadership of the state, political leadership of the state. We recognized that we had fought every political, we had fought every court battle that we knew to fight. And we had lost every time we moved in, whether it was an arbitrary, whether it was a legal decision or one based on the arbitrary caprices of the judges. But nonetheless, we saw that we had no hope there. We realized that the time had come when the tactics that we had previously used had proven to be not fruitful. And I think the people simply resigned themselves to living with what they consider to be a very, very bad and almost impossible situation. But they realized that they were boxed in, there was nothing they could do about it.
But everybody before that, during the 60s, was predicting the state would go to hell in a handcart and go up in flames and so on.
Well, that's true, and let me say this. Some of those predictions indeed were correct, because the quality of education, the quality of instruction and learning in our public schools now has suffered a very visible decline, a deterioration. We have, in the city of Jackson, for instance, these are last year's figures. I haven't seen this year's figures. I haven't had them available, but as of this time last year, there were more white students enrolled in private schools than there were in public schools in the city of Jackson. That's another change. And you find that to be true wherever there is a great percentage of blacks in the population. As a matter of fact, at one time there were one or two counties in the state where there was not a single white child enrolled in a public school.
But yet, roughly 90% of the school enrollment is still in the public schools, isn't that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But you have to understand the population makeup of the state of Mississippi in order to give a reason as to why. Part of that's economic, of course, on the part of persons who are absolutely unable to send their children to private schools, but who would do so if they were financially able. There are other cases where we would have people who are prejudiced against private schools and in favor of public education. By the same token, you have them in reverse. You have those who are prejudiced in favor of private schools against public schools, but there's a certain number on both sides. These people are determined to keep their children in public school no matter how bad the situation may become. I think it has been the advent of the private schools providing an escape valve, you might say, that has helped to keep down some of the problems that we have.
If you were to remove the legal compunctions to maintain this system, suppose the anti-busing amendment that passed the House yesterday succeeded, would the state revert back to segregated schools? Would you ever move back to where you were?
Oh, no. No, I don't. I think it would be wishful thinking to contemplate such a thing. I, as a practical matter, no, I don't think we ever can. However, I think that the amount of or the degree of integration or mixing, if the busing situation is taken care of legislatively, will simply be in proportion to the ratio in the population in that particular school area. I don't raise any question about that.
It would go back to sort of a natural balance for the district that school serves.
Well, we have blacks who live within a white school district, within the district served by a particular elementary or elementary school or high school or what have you. We have mixed neighborhoods. And to that extent, these would be mixed.
What would happen if the Voting Rights Act were not extended?
At this point in Mississippi, I don't think it would make a bit of difference. Except that we wouldn't have to be the host to hordes of invaders from Washington coming down here to sit in on our elections and attempt to dictate to us how we should handle them. I think that would be about the only change. The nigger has now been accepted as a voter. I haven't seen any problem whatsoever connected with that. I feel that they've already wiped out educational requirements and literacy requirements, and there's no way that we can get that reestablished. The busing, so-called busing, has nothing to do with that, the qualifications of voters. I mean the inclusion of Mississippi among the five jurisdictions, I believe, that are presently affected by it. Is it six jurisdictions or five? I don't remember. Mississippi, Alaska, Alabama, Georgia. What other states?
South Carolina, North Carolina, I think Virginia, I think there's about six or seven.
That's right.
Do you anticipate that the Loyalists and the Regulars are going to get back together before the 76 election?
Ain't no way.
What could bring them back together? Well, let me ask you first, why do you feel that way?
One is oil, one's water, one's apple, one's oranges. There's no way to mix them. And there's no catalyst that can put them together because their philosophies, their respective philosophies, are 180 degrees apart.
So you see that situation just continuing as it is?
For a long time to come, yes.
Who could bring it back together?
No individual.
No?
No. No individual.
Could the next governor do it?
No. I don't think so. The so-called Loyalists are not a political party as such. They're not qualified as a political party under our laws, and they have no standing recognized by Mississippi law at this time.
Do you think they'll get the call to the convention in 1976?
I don't understand exactly the question. What was it?
Do you think they'll get the call to the Democratic Convention in 1976?
Not if the leaders of the National Democratic Convention have any sense, they won't. They'll go ahead and proceed under established rules that have always been followed, and they may have representation. They may be able to elect a few delegates. But only if they elect those few delegates will they be able to get them in there.
Do you think delegates will be elected then in 1976 at large? Or?
No, I don't know. That's pending now, you know. In the legislature, I'm not sure just where we stand on it. Since I went out of the governor's office, I refuse to read political news.
We hear some speculation that you might be a candidate for governor in 1975.
Set it aside.
How about the U.S.
What do you
Senate?
Think of the legislature?
That too. I served a 21-year sentence in Washington, and that taught me a lesson not to indulge in the same
if you're wiped
offense
out,
again. I don't think.
If you're written off governor and senator, well, that doesn't leave anything left, does it, to run in the future?
Have you heard of retirement?
Not running for it. No. What do you think of the legislature's action yesterday on overriding the veto of the governor for the first time in modern history?
I don't know enough about it to comment on it. Of course, I know it was a precedent setter.
You had some problems.
As I say, I don't. I've made it a point not to try to stay current on political affairs in the governor's mansion and in the legislature. I just try to make it a point not to do that because ex-governors can be drawn into political controversies not of their own making, so much that I feel that the present governor should be ready to serve without my being consulted or my sticking my big nose into his business. That's what I'm trying to say. I think I would make courtesy.
When you were governor, I think you had some problems with the R&D Center. How do you evaluate that organization?
The R&D Center is potentially a great organization if we could, but my criticism was not of the R&D Center, but of the man who heads the R&D Center, who is a sociologist by education and training, and knows about as much about economic development and that type of thing as I do about atomic energy, which is a flat zero. And that's about as far as I can go from that point. Now, you know, I've had personality conflicts, as he has with the present governor, so I'm told.
What were the significant, the most significant accomplishments of your administration, as compared to other?
The first thing we did was to upgrade the quality of public education in our schools, which frankly had deteriorated to virtually nothing. We gave the school teachers, the highest single pay raise in one lump that they'd ever received in the history of the state. At that time, we brought our teachers up to a level comparable to the level of salaries in the surrounding states for the first time since I can remember. We provided a number of new, we also revised the law so as to reduce the number of students per teaching unit. We also added a per cost factor to each teacher's unit. I would prefer that you ask the school people themselves about that, because don't take my word. But I think probably that was the first and most notable and most important accomplishment of the administration there. The second thing, we were able to pass what at that time was the largest highway construction program in the history of the state. The first major highway construction program that had been passed since 1938. It was not passed in exactly the form that I asked. It was that I requested. It was watered down because I lost on the financing of the program by two votes in the Senate after it had passed the House by an overwhelming vote. But we came back and we were able to still get the largest program which had ever been passed up to that point in the history of the state, including the 1938 program. We completed our educational television network. We revised and overhauled our entire revenue structure, put the state in good, sound financial condition, and I left the largest surplus, if you want to call it that, the largest balance in the state treasury when I left office that had ever been seen in the history of Mississippi. We established an Office of Federal State Relations, the Office of the Coordinator of Federal State Programs, or State Federal Programs, who incidentally did such a good job that he was elected to the United States Congress from his congressional district this last time, Mr. David Bowen. Of course, I went through the trauma of Hurricane Camille and its recovery, which has been described by the National Civil Defense Office as the finest example of federal-state cooperation, disaster cooperation in history, and we rewrote the book, so to speak, for disaster relief. Oh, the just touching on a few more. Passed legislation that would permit our participation in the Medicaid program. We set it up, set up the Medicaid program. Just off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of others. We went from a biennial session of the legislature to an annual session. Our state construction program was accelerated considerably. We upgraded our Negro colleges in particular, placed emphasis on Jackson State, Delta Valley State, and Alcorn, and got them some much needed capital improvements. The creation of the Governor's Emergency Council immediately following Hurricane Camille, according to the National Civil Defense people, has set a pattern for other states to follow when they suffer similar disasters. We cleaned our statute books of practically all of the old segregation laws, etc., which were had been placed on there in an attempt to frustrate the federal attempts to integrate us in the early days.
Governor, on that question, why did you continue the Sovereignty Commission?
By that time, the Sovereignty Commission had changed its approach in some way and was acting as an intelligence agency so that we could keep track of those who were coming into the state to create trouble. I mean physical trouble. I mean physical violence, that type of thing. Witness the RNA incident, which occurred here in Jackson, that's one. So that we stayed a step ahead of them most of the time. Now, part of it went to the Ku Klux Klan and its operations. They were under surveillance all the time, too, so that we knew generally in advance what their plans were going to be. Now, we had had a series of bombings, if you remember, of church and synagogue bombings, church burnings by night riders. All that disappeared during the 4 years that I was in office.
What major things you wanted to get done, you didn't?
The only major thing that I had advocated that I wanted to get done that I was unable to get done was the passage, the enactment of the original highway legislation, which I had advocated in my campaign. However, I might add that as soon as I went out of office, a new man came in. He had run on the same type of platform. The legislature completed the job and went ahead and proceeded to write my original act into law so that we now have the construction bill. The sad part being that in the meantime costs had accelerated and we were not going to get as much highway for our money as we would have previously.
Were you the first governor ever to come out of Congress in Mississippi?
You mean directly from the Congress?
Right.
No. Our first governor came directly from the Congress, George Poindexter.
Were you the first then governor since this century then?
George Poindexter served from 1817, I believe, to 1819.
You're the first one since him.
That's right.
How do you feel about that, your experience in Washington relating to the governor's office?
I think it was invaluable.
Do you think you'd have been better off if you'd served, say, come directly out of the legislature or lieutenant governor's office?
I feel that I would have been better off had I had some service in the legislature previously. But if I had to make a choice of whether I was coming from, say, 20 years in the Congress or 20 years in the state legislature, probably 20 years in the state legislature would have qualified me a bit better, but I think it's half-splitting to say either one at this point.
What would have been the special advantages you found of having been in Congress?
In, well, 40 years ago, it wouldn't have been, it wouldn't have amounted to anything. However, in this day and time, the state's activities are so closely intertwined and interlinked with federal activities that I think it's definitely an advantage that, that a man should have had service in the Congress before he goes to the governor's office. I don't think that should be a requirement. Please don't misunderstand me, but I think it helps. It helps because, after all, I was on a first-name basis with virtually everybody in Washington, in the Washington agencies, and, of course, in the Congress. I knew where to go in Washington to get done what we needed to be done. And I could sit down across the table and talk eyeball to eyeball to most of the officials there.
There seemed to be somewhat of a growing tendency. You came back from Washington as governor. Congressman Watson from South Carolina came back and ran for governor. Governor Edwards in Louisiana came out of Congress.
Archmore from West Virginia.
Brian Dorn is running this year in South Carolina. Do you see this as a continuing trend?
I can't answer that question. I don't know. It's been a year since I've been to Washington. It's been 2 years since I've been out of office. It's been about 7 years since I left Washington as a congressman. And, of course, I just don't know. I can't answer that question. What's his name? Bill Cahill from New Jersey was also elected governor from the Congress since I was governor, or since I went into office.
After the 1964 election, when you were stripped of your seniority in Congress, mm-hmm. you and Congressman Watson, and he switched to the Republican Party, and you did not. Why not?
Because I was not in conflict with the rules of the Mississippi Democratic, regular Democratic Party. Mississippi Regular Democratic Party in convention had already adopted resolutions that would free any member of the Mississippi Democratic Party to vote for the candidate of his choice, regardless of party, for president and vice president. And that is a point which the National Democratic group failed to respond to. I was acting purely within the rules of the Mississippi Democratic Party.
Did you consider a party switch at that time?
Yes, I considered the possibility of a party switch, but I felt that as long as I was not in violation of any of the rules of the Mississippi Democratic Party, and I was still in sympathy with the advocacies and the philosophies of the Mississippi Democratic Party, that they would serve no purpose to change to another party. At this point in time, the Mississippi Democratic Party is more an independent party than it is a partisan party, so to speak. We've been denied admission to the last two Democratic conventions, so I think we'd have to say that it's more an independent party than it is a Democratic party.
In future statewide races, do you see the elections being determined primarily by the personality of the candidates
yes,
more than anything
very
else?
Definitely. Definitely so. As a matter of fact, if I should ever run for governor again and as a matter of expediency, seek to select the party that or the ticket that I felt would best advance my interests, I'd be hard put to determine whether to run as a Democrat, Republican, or Independent. Probably I'd run as an Independent if I ever ran for office again.
Why?
Because I am an Independent.
Independent of what? The Democratic Party?
I'm independent of the party.
What does an Independent have to do to get on the ballot in Mississippi? Petition?
A petition, yes.
If this open primary law gets approved by the Attorney General, do you think there'll be a lot more candidates running as independents?
Probably so, yes.
What do you think would have to happen for Mississippi to again go Democratic in a presidential election?
I think they will have to come to Mississippi and show us that they want us in the Mississippi, in the national party. I think they would have to give us a voice in the councils of the party, which we have not had for the past 25 or 30 years. And I think that they would have to would have to discard some of the arbitrary, and I put it, I say arbitrary, the arbitrary, ultra-liberal rules which have been established in the, within the National Democratic Party, quota systems, that type of thing, and bring it back purely to a democratic system, and I think we could live with that.
If Governor Wallace were were to actively campaign for the Democratic national ticket, whether or not he's on it, as I assume he's not on it, actively campaign for it, would it make a significant difference in Mississippi?
It would make some difference, but not, it wouldn't be a controlling factor. That depends, from a standpoint of party, no. That depends to a great extent on the individuals who might be nominated by the two national parties, their respective platforms and advocacies.
Do you see race reemerging as a political issue in Mississippi?
No.
With race emerged as an issue, do you see Mississippi reverting back to the traditional economic liberalism it had of an earlier period?
With race as an issue?
With race emerged as an issue?
No, I don't. Not at any time in the foreseeable future. Most of that so-called economic liberalism was the result of a populist movement, as you know, that was very popular back in the days of, let's say, between 1900 and 1930, or in the pre-Roosevelt days. Of course, Mississippi was a great supporter of Roosevelt. But our people feel that government should serve and not rule, and our people are staunch believers in the premise of the 10th Amendment, which apparently has been wiped completely off the books by, as a matter of practicality, by the courts, and is not even recognized as being law anymore. But our people still feel that we have too much government. There's too much attempt to regulate their lives, to regulate and control their lives from Washington, and that we're not left sufficiently free to do the things that we believe to be best for us and for our people. As long as, I'll put it another way, in the years prior to the 1930s, we were a farm economy, a cotton economy, practically all depending on the prosperity of cotton as such. Back in those days, the great clamor and cry was Wall Street. Wall Street was the great enemy of our people. And politicians would be elected by excoriating Wall Street and holding it up as their straw man, whether it was a straw man on actual threat, I don't know. But today, people have their own businesses. We are enjoying prosperity. We realize now that everything that the government gives, it must first take away from the people. And the government produces nothing. But the people produce the prosperity. The government simply acts as a middleman to take their production away from them and distribute it. So I don't think that, for instance, Huey Long, and he was in the context of his time, I suppose he was a fair popular real crusader. Maybe in the context of his times, he was a man of the hour. But times have changed, and I hardly think that you'd find that type of approach today. being very effective in Mississippi.
Some people talk about Governor Wallace's victory, that it was give a lot of credit to the type of media campaign he ran. Do you think that was a decisive factor?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt but that the type of campaign that he ran was very effective, particularly in the absence of resistance on the other side. Now, I don't want to get involved in the campaign, that campaign, please. There were mistakes made by his opponent, which didn't help his situation. Judgment mistakes. And his supporters, I think, were overconfident.
Can we talk about the campaign of 71? Why do you think he won that second primary?
Who?
You.
I'm 67.
I'm sorry, 67.
Man, I had that thing won when I saw the results from the first primary. I knew that I won it. I had won it. Because I knew that it was a certain block vote. Well, I could analyze that very easily. I knew that I would get the Barnett vote, the great bulk of it. I knew that I would get the Swan vote, the great bulk of it. And putting those together, well, we knew that the question was just how big the majority was going to be. And then I worked, and I worked hard. And I presented the case, my case open and above board. That's not to infer that the other side didn't either. I don't mean that, but I presented my case open and above board, and we won it.
Anything about your administration you'd done differently?
Well, I'm sure there were a number of things I would have done differently. I might have made a few personnel choices differently had I known then what I know now. But by and large, I think my approach would have been about the same.
If you were elected governor again...
There are one or two bills perhaps that I should have vetoed that I didn't veto. And the primary reason that I didn't veto them was because of my very high respect for our legislative system. That it's the legislature's responsibility to write the laws and the executive's responsibility to administer and execute the laws. And the great majority of the legislature favors a matter. I don't feel that it's, unless there is something in there that is wholly repugnant, I don't think that either repugnant or unreasonable or what have you.
That, most people describe the...
In other words, I am very, very reluctant to try to place my judgment above that of the collective judgment of the legislature.
Most people view the Mississippi legislature as very strong and the executive as very weak.
There's no question of that.
Well,
no question.
Would you have changed anything in those terms of those relationships?
Oh, indeed I would.
How would you change that?
Indeed I would. I would attempt to get reorganization. Waller has been seeking reorganization. I think he's getting down to details, I'm not sure about that, but I think we need a reorganization. As far as I know, this is the only state, or perhaps one of the few states, for example, in which the legislature prepares the executive's budget request for him and submits it to themselves for approval. I would seek to change the executive boards and commissions so as to make them real executive boards and commissions rather than legislative boards and commissions, and to enforce the second paragraph of the first article of the state constitution, which is the separation of powers clause. And I think that someday someone will have the initiative and the wherewithal to go into court and force it.
Why hasn't that ever been challenged? Why hasn't
it has been challenged? It has been challenged, not in the courts. But I believe that an Attorney General, Greek Rice, I believe it is Greek Rice, and then it was upheld by Joe Patterson later, wrote an opinion which was to serve a particular purpose at a particular time, I presume, in which he made a distinction between legislators serving on executive boards and commissions with a definite term of years, and those who were simply appointed subject to the will of the governor, in other words. For instance, he made the distinction that if a particular commission appointment was for 6 years or 4 years or what have you, and a definite term appointment, that it would be in violation. But the legislature was given the right to, at the same time under this ruling, to name ex officio members of these boards and commissions who would serve, in other words, to require that members of the legislature be selected for certain positions, but without a definite term of office. And I think that violates both the spirit and the letter, but that's neither here nor there. I'm not in a position to say that it's bad law. The courts are going to have to say that, and I think they will in time.
Governor, if you were elected again, would you have a black on your staff?
I wouldn't go search out a black to put on my staff, no. I wouldn't go search one out just because he was black. And I certainly would not have one on there if I thought he would disrupt the operations. I don't think that I would object to having a qualified black on my staff.
Some governors have put in the South now put blacks on their staff, and some as a general staff member, some specifically to deal with what they refer to usually as minority affairs.
Mm-hmm.
How about an appointment of blacks to boards and commissions? Would you change your policy on that?
What do you mean change my policy?
Well, you didn't.
I appointed blacks to boards and commissions.
Would you appoint more?
I don't know. If more qualified ones appeared, I suppose. And they happen to be political friends of mine, they might be appointed. You've got to remember that politics is a game, and you scratch my back, and I'll scratch yours in politics. And I felt that out of the tremendous majority of people who supported me for governor, that I could certainly find qualified people to put in these positions, and I couldn't find a single qualified black that supported me for governor. You're not expected to put your political enemies in office. If you do, you're a fool.
Do you think if you ran again, you'd have qualified blacks supporting you?
I would suspect so. I really would. I think I would have several college presidents supporting me. Depending, of course, on who was opposed, I mean, who I was running against, and what the issues, and the issues that might develop.
Is there anything else you wanted to add that I'll understand?
Can I ask you one more thing?
Now, you fellows have dealt with black and white now for half an hour. You want to get around something else? That's always what they want to talk to me about. And if I'd known that, I'd told you, hell no, I'm not even going to talk to you. I'm tired of talking black and white.
When you served in the National Governor's Conference and with your colleagues in the Governor's Conference, is there any difference between Mississippi and the rest of the South, or Mississippi and the rest of the nation?
How do you mean?
Well, are its people any different? Or, you know,
they have different attitudes, of course, but, you know, my last year I served as chairman of the Southern Governors Conference, which I think is in itself a fairly good refutation of the idea that Mississippi is looked down upon by its sister states. And this was a 19-jurisdiction conference, largest in the country. I served as a member of the Executive Committee of the Council of State Governments, which is, I believe, had five governors on it. I don't think that is an indication that Mississippi is held in contempt by its sister states or by the governors of the sister states.
That's what I was getting at, and they don't see Mississippi as somehow different than the rest of the...
No, I think we've long since... Mississippi's long since outlived that label. As a matter of fact, I think the manner in which Mississippi has acted in accommodation of things that we were forced to do very much against our will, speaks probably better for the state of Mississippi than any other state in the Union. Because we're the people who have the problem. People far removed from our problems have sought to solve our problems for us without consulting us. And I think that we have done a very commendable job in adjusting to meet these forced criteria, I'll say.
You said that, you know, earlier, that was partly the function of the political leaders of the state during that time. But how do you look at the people in that regard? I mean, it also has got to be part of the character of the people, does it not?
Yes, people respond, though, to their leaders. There's several ways I could have stood up at this particular time, and I'm not reflecting on any other governor or former governor. Please don't misunderstand me, because in the context of the times, perhaps they did what was right and what was best. But I sought to be conciliatory. I sought to be to ask the people to leave these problems in the hands of the duly constituted authorities, not to take the law in their own hands. Some governors in the past have suggested that they should take it in their own hands. They did take it in their own hands, and we suffered as a result. It was bad judgment.